to plenary number three. So we have the, we're still on the levers. So it's what levers will become important in the next decade. Once again, we have two different panels with the same moderator. So the moderator will be Ian Capstick, founder of Media Style, and you may or may not have seen him on CBC's Power and Politics at some point. The first panel is on emotion and technology, and your speakers are Supriya Sayal. Supriya is the former chief behavioral scientist at the Privy Council Office, Government of Canada. In this role, she has worked to create a scale and culture of evidence-based decision-making across government and drive the use of behavioral science for social impact through improvements in federal policies and programs. So that's your first speaker. Your second one is Ethan Wilding from L4 Ventures. Ethan is a co-founder of L4 Ventures and Ledger Labs and an early founding team member of Ethereum. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Waterloo. So that's your first panel on the topic of emotion and technology. And then after that, we're going to switch to the next one on equity and justice. And so then we have Catherine Green from the Response Innovation Lab. Catherine is a humanitarian professional who has responded to some of the biggest natural disasters over the last decade. She knows that the world can do a better job in responding to these kind of disasters and is committed to being part of making future humanitarian responses better. And we have Kamau Bob, who's from the Constellation Center for Equity in Computing. Kamau is the director of the Constellation Center for Equity in Computing at Georgia Tech. His work focuses on the relationship between equity for students and communities in the STEM enterprise, large educational systems, and the social and structural conditions that influence contemporary American life. So with that, we'll have two panels. I'd like to bring up Ian Capstick and the first panel.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hi. Folks at the back, sitting up there, your backs are going to start hurting. If you wouldn't mind, come close, fill in these chairs up front. Seriously, up, 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 let's go. All of you at the back, come on in. Don't be afraid. Come on, there we go. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Come on up, fill it in. I still see a weird circle that was formed here on this side that's very odd, to say the least. These are the things Vinod and Jason tell us to do, so we have to. Right? That's how it works in this town, isn't it? Thank you so much. I want to acknowledge again the territory that we are on here. This is unceded Algonquin territory. I want to remind you that unless you are Anishinaabe, unless you're Algonquin, you're actually an uninvited guest to this space. At no point were we as colonizers, as settlers, invited here to this territory. At no point did they enter treaty negotiation with us here in this unceded territory. And I think it's important to just explain what that really and actually means, which is that about an hour and a half from here is a place that I have spent a lot of time at Kitigan-Zibi, and they don't have running water. And a woman that we work really, really closely with, Elder Claudette Commanda, who some of you will have known as the elder who has kicked off many, many innovation sessions, social impact sessions, and very notably the work of the MMIWG, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry. Her home on Kitigan-Zibi has no running water. Okay, so that is, 90 minutes from where we are today. When we heard from the Algonquins of Barrier Lake, a very similar situation. So I just want to center that, and I also want to thank our organizers for centering this worldview as much as we can and challenge each of you to take up the call to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Each and every one of you will find a specific call to action in there for you, because reconciliation, as Senator Sinclair has said so many times, is not an Indigenous issue. It's an issue for all citizens in this country. So thank you again to this territory, to this land. Ethan, come on up. I will now sit. I'm so lucky to be hosting this afternoon's panels with four people who I have had an incredible amount of respect for since the very moment that I discovered their work. And Ethan's work is some work that I discovered pretty early on because he's a founding member of the Ethereum group. That probably just baffled half of you in the room. So real honest, because we're in like a safe space. How many of you are like super comfortable and like, yeah, I know Ethereum. I know what that is. I get it. Yeah, one?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jamal. Thanks, Priya. Okay. How many of you folks are at the point where you think you might understand just a little bit about blockchain? Like, you kind of have the basics, just a little bit. Just a bit. Okay. How many of you folks are super fluent? You've got it, 100% down. Could come up here.
Gosh, I don't even put my hand up for that.
I love it, right? Because it's in evolution. Okay, so that gives us, we promised Ethan we would do just a little bit of that guidance to start off this conversation, because this is groundbreaking technology. And like a lot of technology, people are completely baffled by it when it first comes out. I mean, just remember when you all first joined Twitter, how complicated that was. Tell us a little bit about it. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about how you started in this, and then we'll dig into some of the technology questions.
So I'll just start, I guess, with a brief, very high-level overview of what this blockchain stuff is, without going too technical. First off, the banking system is broken. We know that it's like centralized, like shadow banking systems. We've got a lot of like multi-billion-dollar banks that can essentially do what they want, have regulatory capture, and you have no access into their book of records. You have no idea what's happening on those transactions and how much. Well, you get an idea of how many fees they're charging, but you can't do anything about it. You're at the mercy of them if you want to send transactions to somebody else, and they're going to charge fees for doing that, and they're going to delay it oftentimes because when they get like a lot of wire transfers coming through. They'll delay it so they can earn money off the money that they'll say it's going to take like 5 days to process. In the meantime, they're using that cash to earn interest for themselves, and then they take it along. It's so inefficient, and there's no incentive for them to change and to like stop using their customers and their people because they have too much control. So that's one part. There's like massive centralization of services. The second part is you've got no control over how much money gets printed. So there's like quantitative easing, inflation, government stuff. They'll just print, pay off their loans and keep borrowing more on that route. And it gets complicated, but the fact is you don't control that. And if you hold money in fiat and legacy currencies, you're literally losing cash, right, because being devalued by your governments. So this is a problem, and how do we make sure that people can take some control back? So Bitcoin blockchain, right, was a solution to that kind of problem, right? So it has two things. One, it has a fixed rate of issuance, so you know exactly how many Bitcoin are going to be produced. And it's in the code. If you want to partake in the system, there's no shadow banking system. You're not worried about, well, you know, are they going to print like 10% more this year, 20% more? It's guaranteed. You know exactly how much is there. And the second part is, well, the huge problem with the centralization, we got into the financial crisis because of, well, largely these central actors were bad actors, right? And there's nothing you could do about it. So let's have a different sort of system. And the way to do that is like decentralized options. But it wasn't really possible before Bitcoin to have a fully decentralized system was before. To keep one of the bad features you want to have in a one of the bad things you don't want in a financial system is to be able to modify balances after the fact. It's really good if I can just add like a few million dollars to my account, but bad for other people. And that's what the banker's service they tend to say that they're doing is they keep the ledger of accounts, the records of the financial system, and saying like, yeah, take money out of my account and transfer to this other person, and you know, take a bunch of fees for it, right? So that's some value that they're adding. Before Bitcoin, right, it wasn't possible to have a mechanism for removing that central actor and still solving that double spend problem and still making sure that everybody's balances were correct at the end of the day or at the end of every transaction. So it was quite an amazing thing for the Bitcoin option to come out is using terms like crypto-economic incentives and stuff as how to get rational actors globally around the world to keep this ledger of accounts, this bank book, right, ledger technology stuff, right, a bank book secured. So anybody can participate, nobody's going to be denied accounts, fully open sourced, and you have full transparency into every single transaction that's going along. That's like going into RBC and saying, show me every single transaction that's happened from the very conception of RBC, every single transaction. And that's what a Bitcoin blockchain allows you to do, and same with future other blockchains. So Ethereum comes out, it's a project that we built largely in Canada. Like, well, a lot of us from Canada, we're from Canada. We had to, for a whole bunch of political reasons and stuff, right, and tax and other reasons. We had the form in Switzerland. but here's the thing, not for the tax reasons. We formed in Switzerland because we couldn't get guarantees we weren't going to go to jail in Canada, right? And we actually also had to, like, hire the SEC chairman's own law firm to say, like, when we do this thing, we're not going to go to jail for doing this. They're not going to come after us. And, like, it's crazy, right? But we're worried about this stuff. And it's still not clear how this is going to play out. They still might come after us. But Nevertheless, we did that just because we're as entrepreneurs, right, and trying to build this new infrastructure, realizing this is going to be huge, we wanted to make sure that we didn't not just go to jail, right, but we would make sure there's less risk. Like, the regulatory risk is huge for us because there's enough business risk. There's enough, like, innovation risk that we're taking. And security risks, we wanted to make sure that we minimize the regulatory kind of stuff, right?
And because we're talking about emotion, what led you emotionally from that point to lead and to go into this form of tech? Not just to go into it and invest in it, but really to lead it. Yeah. What was the emotional underpinning of those decisions?
So I'd rather exist in a world where it's a lot more access to the technology is a lot more democratized, mm-hmm. and access to this, like, the financial system. And it just seemed a lot more fair to anybody. And I liked the idea that no central actor can come and seize my funds or my accounts or take control over my... Now, funny enough, I just started using Facebook the other day. No, as of today, this is the third time they've locked me out of my account because suspicious activity. What the heck does that mean? So upload a photo of me, okay? But I've done that. Now my third time I've done that. And this is it's like another central actor that determines whether I have access to that system.
Isn't it great that the blockchain guy just joined Facebook, right? You can all feel a little, technologically advanced.
Well, I'm like hyper-private. So
I could not possibly imagine a blockchain guy wanting to be hyper-private either. Sabri, why don't you join us up here? We'll continue to talk because this is leading us into these questions of trust.
And I think just as Sabri is coming up, I just wanted to finish off on the Ethereum project quickly. So for those who aren't aware, the Bitcoin project is really good at just transferring, like, the Bitcoin token. It's one little unit of value. It's like just transfer the US dollar, or the email can just transfer email. And that's a very limited kind of system. For Ethereum, we wanted to build a fully generalized programmable blockchain, kind of like what you have with the internet and JavaScript. You can build anything on top of that. So why not build a system, which we did with Ethereum, so you take this whole blockchain, decentralized, censorship-resistant technology with all the benefits you might get from Bitcoin and a lot more, and make it so you can build, like, any type of business logic or applications on top of it. And that's kind of where...
What are you building on it right now?
Personally?
Sure.
Well, we're doing, state channels. So one of the issues we have is for scalability. We want to... You can't just write every single transaction to the chain because it costs a bit of money and it's going to create bloat. So it'd be nicer to have, some side channels so you can run, like, thousands of transactions on the side and then only write twice to the chain. So it saves money, it has more privacy guarantees, and there's a lot of other use cases.
Awesome. And we'll get into it. I think that's kind of interesting. And as it relates to the work of Supriya, who's our former chief behavioral scientist at the Privy Council office, which, believe me, there's a lot of people to investigate over there. just saying. It was like a living laboratory. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Supriya, what do you think about this? Where are you at on Ethereum, Bitcoin, these types of things? How are you seeing your role in this technological advancement as a behavioral scientist?
Nice setup for my former. I'll get to that in a second. If you don't mind my just sort of framing the argument a little bit. But even before I do that, you know, there's an interesting study looking at judges making parole decisions, and you basically find that they start out at about 65% in the morning, that's sort of at the beginning of the day, and as they make more and more and more decisions, that rate goes lower and lower and lower and lower towards like 0% immediately before lunch, and immediately after lunch spikes right back up to 65% again.
Oh, wow.
This holds irrespective of the criminality of the situation. So
what you're saying is all of these people should be super engaged right now.
Exactly.
Right?
Because other than the distressing thing that says about the criminal justice system, I'm happy to be the post-lunch panel. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about behavioral science because I was asked specifically to focus on emotion. That is what I will do, but it's part of my personal mission to evangelize the use of behavioral science for institutions. So wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Ask me later. What I was asked to comment on is the use of emotion and specifically the use of anger as a tool for social good. And I want to situate that in the context of this sort of tension we've been exploring all day between transformational change and redistribution, which is much more incremental. And I'm not, and the consensus appears to be that we need transformation. You know, we're not making enough headway. And I buy into this. I'm not against this in any way. But I do wanna highlight that in the absence of redistribution, transformation itself becomes the prerogative of the privileged. So if we don't redistribute, we are limiting our ability to transform the world to the already transformed part of the world. And so to me, it appears that these things need to go hand in hand, and even like what you would call transformative technologies or transformative tools, such as, you know, cryptocurrencies, have a significant role to play in this, obviously they're transformative definitionally, but they also have a role to play in just incremental change in how we're talking about wealth in the world or poverty in the world. So that's one. And the link from that to anger is, you know, you just asked Ethan what drove him to this, and he didn't say this, but in most cases, whether it's transformational change or incremental change or whatever kind of change may be, people are driven to making change because there is some sort of injustice that they perceive or something that makes them mad enough to actually do something about it. And that's where the sort of, you know, I want to explore this dimension of anger as a tool for social good. So anger gets a really bad rap, right? Like, you got to control that. Anger makes you cray. It makes you do, like, at the same time, anger is a really complex emotion. So it's negative, like, say, fear or disgust. But those things, fear and disgust, are emotions that make you avoid things, right? You want to withdraw from things that make you afraid or make you disgusted. Anger is not about flight, it's about fight. You step forward into the arena to actually engage with something. And this can lead to people acting like Looney Tunes, but what this also leads to is you can become much more deliberate and much more reflective in your thinking. Angry people are actually much more creative people, and you can show this experimentally in both a neuroscience context and just a psychology experiment context. Angry people are also more optimistic people. Angry people, that sort of, that burst of adrenaline that you get and the other, you know, catecholamines, other chemicals that your brain is releasing, does two things. A, it consolidates memory so you can hold on to that thing that made you angry and you can respond to it. And B, it provides this energy that allows you to sort of engage in more unstructured thinking, which again is bad in some cases, but in other cases, when channeled correctly, can lead you to find out-of-the-box solutions that you wouldn't have found otherwise. And anger is unparalleled as an emotion for driving social movements. So when we talk about mobilizing people for social good, revolutions are built on rage. A lot of things have happened in the wake of the Trump presidency that are, you know, yeah, like there's, you can use any number. There's like, my God, okay. What has also happened is we've seen an unprecedented social movement, things like the Women's March, the March for Science, other sort of agents coming together to protest and to drive social change for greater inclusivity or good. And these movements are driven by collective and sustained anger that has been channeled in the right way. And as of this month, November, the highest number of women ever, by a margin of over 100%, are now running for Congress in the U.S., driven by anger. So I just would like to pose this sort of, you know, question to the audience or as actors who are working in this social impact space. How are we creating institutions, or how are we creating space for people to feel, express, or use anger as a tool for social good in the work that we do?
And I like that idea. I love this idea that you have that anger fuels movements and revolutions. And we're in a technological revolution right now as it relates to blockchain. What's the role of anger in your world?
I think as Supriya was saying, obviously the current system, something about the current system's not right, or at least back in the earlier days when you're starting this blockchain stuff, and you get involved in it because you can make a difference, you finally have the technical tools, right, to like have a lasting impact, a potentially lasting impact, right?
Let's dig into that, Ethan. How can blockchain start to support some of these movements, some of this anger?
So, in quite a few ways. One project, for instance, we've funded called Udara, which probably called it Better You or something in, with a rebrand. It's tackling the charity market. So right now with the charities, it's very opaque. Oftentimes, like you say, you donate to the Red Cross and $500 million disappears, right, into Haiti or something, right? And you don't know where this money went. You've got no transparency to track like how this stuff is being spent. So we built a system where you essentially incentivize volunteers. Now, whether the volunteers now is going to be a different question, but if you want lasting movements to succeed, like Occupy Wall Street or various like charity offices through USAID, Amnesty International, they can't just rely on volunteer effort. So we'd rather, like, if I'm going to put my money into this these projects, I want to incentivize these people to work on like things that actually have get accomplished goals. So like whether it's cleaning up a park or setting up the Wi-Fi routers or building a building or house or the doors or do the plumbing.
What are the most practical examples on the ground right now in the blockchain world where this is happening?
Also, the one of this for this particular project, or
any project, sort of. Yeah. Just, I'm looking to extend the applicability of the technology to the ground. What's working in this space?
Well, one like the UN, we had people presenting on the World Food Program earlier. So one of the projects with Ethereum is we have a lot, millions of refugees in the world, and one of the issues when you're trying to deliver food aid to refugees is you can't give them identity cards, you can't give them like food tokens, because that's going to get stolen. They're going to be held up by thugs, right? So you essentially get like little mini bands of warlords in these various camps. So we've partnered with the World Food Program to do a system where they'll do retinal scans and to deliver food. So that'll be their identity, which is much harder to forge that, thankfully, and manage the like distribution and the allocation and management of the food resources through retinal scans and Ethereum on the World Food Program.
Well, and Supriya, we know from the introduction of technology here in Canada that it requires time, education. So what's the role of behavioral science in perhaps hastening technological adoption or acceptance?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think it depends on the kind of technology you're referring to. So some things are innately a little harder to understand because there is an element of training associated with the fundamental build-up. So things such as blockchain or cryptocurrency, you know, there might be where I think, yeah, there's certainly, if we as a nation, we as a people decide, look, this is really something we want to evangelize, most definitely, so from a behavioral science perspective, there are ways to make information much easier to understand. There's ways to highlight particular forms of information by making it salient. There's ways to motivate people, greater attention, and then also greater action from people. All of this using, you know, just principles of behavioral science, and those could certainly be directed at something. Should we all decide that's what we wanted to do? The other sort of angle to, you know, behavioral science and technology is that we know from experiments looking at how people interface with digital information, so information on screens essentially, that human beings appear to process information differently on a screen relative to not on a screen. And without exception, but the general trend appears to be you process information worse on a screen than you do on paper. So we can show that, you know, you can have people read a PDF and you read it just like a hard copy PDF or the same damn PDF on a screen, and comprehension is worse, memory is worse, people do many more errors and attention tasks, just like people are much more rash on touchscreen devices compared to non-touchscreen. So there's all these kinds of...
This might explain why the comment section of every newspaper is so angry.
So that, to your point, yeah, so... So there's also this thing of anonymity, right? That the anonymity that the screen engenders, sometimes despite your name being associated with it, it allows you to engage in the form of sometimes frankness, but sometimes taking that too far to the point of, you know, mm-hmm. saying things that are somewhat ludicrous in a screen context that you wouldn't in a face-to-face context. But just to come back to that point, my point is that since we know from behavioral science that people interact with information differently in a digital context and a non-digital one, as we move towards a digital world, as we are building policy for inclusivity in a digital world, I think it is important that, you know, people who are working in that space interface with people who are working in the behavioral science space so that we can actually do it right. You know, we've already messed up the analog world. Like, we already built it with not people in mind, and now we're retrofitting it to be like, oops, hang on, let's think about people. How are they going to respond?
Well, I mean, this is kind of awesome because we have Ethan here who's on the founding team of a brand new technology, right? Yeah. Something that is not even, as you were explaining before to me, yet in really consumers' faces yet. It hasn't been there. So when you're listening to Supriya, Ethan, what do you think the role of behavioral science is in your world, or how might you tap on Supriya in the next couple of weeks to say, hey, how can we improve digital comprehension online? Because pretty much all of your world is screen-based.
Yeah, I actually think that the technology should be really boring. That we keep talking about blockchain this and it's going to revolutionize stuff, and like, oh, what version of blockchain are you using? Or what, Ethereum or Hyperledger or Bitcoin or something? Like, who cares? That's as boring a discussion as what version of JavaScript are you using, right? No one cares. Really, it should be like, all right, what problem are you solving? And the nice thing about what's kind of revolutionary more on the BIC or the blockchain side of stuff is it enables you to solve a whole new classes of problems in ways that just weren't solvable in the past. Mm. So like, you can, I'm gonna come back to Supriya's point in a second. Look first at the problem you're trying to issue. Like, so the World Food Program, right? We wanna like solve this refugee food distribution problem. And then it's like, all right, how do we do that? What's the right kind of technology to do that? And then on like stuff like Ethereum, the advantages here is you can now have things that are like ideologically aligned to things like decentralization, censorship resistance, and stuff like that, and full inclusion, again, open source, and it doesn't restrict like who can participate in this, and it's near free to you. So it has a lot of really good features and benefits that you can take advantage of to solve the particular thing you're looking for.
What are the drawbacks?
I think the drawbacks are kind of technical. But I think like, we definitely want to look at like what Supriya was saying is, how are people going to be using this type of system? How can we design, like say the World Food Program thing, so a way that those people don't have to think about, oh, this is blockchain tech, yay, wonderful, no, can I have my food? Right? They just want, like, can we get the food? Is this going to work? Can I feed my family and myself? And if that involves like interaction with a digital screen or like some technical thing, design the technology, the human-facing side of the technology, so the humans can actually use it well. And like that's where like supreme behavioral economics comes in, right? Is to help navigate that and help them make good decisions, on that. Right? So.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think it's also, you know, it's like this poverty alleviation, like goal number one kind of thing, and to the sort of the food. I mean, there's also data, and you guys, you know, you work in the sector, you probably know this, but there's data to show that poverty imposes a cognitive tax. Right? Indy this morning was talking about how it imposes a 10.
Can you say that again? Because I think that's really key.
Poverty imposes a cognitive tax on you. Indy this morning referred to a 10-point drop in IQ. It's actually a 13-point drop in IQ. You can show, for instance, you can take the same farmers and have them do a bunch of math problems immediately before the harvest and immediately after the harvest. And in this case, the harvest is their sole source of income for the whole year. So just before the harvest, they're in a state of poverty because they've used up most of the money from last year and they're worried about what's going to happen. And they're way worse before than after, and it's the same people. Mm-hmm. So it constrains your already limited mental processing ability, which, you know, we all are like deluged with information, and that's why we use mental heuristics anyway. But so in the context of poverty, this becomes way worse. And so A, that says various things about how we should be structuring social programs to create bandwidth as opposed to take it away, but also in the context of this kind of work now. So when you know, cryptocurrency or when these new tools are being used for these great purposes, and I full-heartedly agree with Ethan, it's about the amazing new questions that now we can find answers to, or challenges that we can find solutions to, how are we factoring in this kind of understanding that, look, we are building for people who need us to maybe build a little bit differently than we would if we were just building for you know, non-poverty stricken people, for instance, in this example.
Thank you so much. Very, very exciting kind of intersection of technology, emotion, and behavioral science in that first. I want to get really tactical. I really want to get to the ground level. And incredibly, we have a humanitarian who has been at this on the ground for well over a decade. And I want to talk to you, Catherine, just a little bit about this. What does that mean, like humanitarian? That's a huge term. What does this mean to you specifically? Describe your work, I suppose, generally to people. Mm-hmm. How do you describe yourself, or how do you tell your family what you do?
So my general pitch is that I work on and I respond to humanitarian disasters, specifically in the Southeast Asia region, predominantly natural disasters. I go in and I try and make order from chaos, and I try and pull together people to kind of do that work alongside me. Not that my family ever asked me what I do. They're just like, you need a lift to the airport again? Okay, get in.
I love that. So you rush in when others rush out, when other people are evacuating from places, when they're running away. It's you and your teams that are perhaps already on the ground, people that you're working with, and then you actually go into these zones yourself.
Yeah, so oftentimes I work for a large international NGO, so oftentimes the first responders are our local staff who are on the ground, and I think that's really important to remember that most of the humanitarian workers in the world don't look like me. They look like people from the country where the emergency is happening. And oftentimes I'll support remotely to start to, you know, pull a team together of technical gaps that might need to be filled, or try and get the funding that needs to kind of come in. And yes, oftentimes I will go into some of these places to support or to manage the response.
But in your decade of doing this, of going into these areas, you've noticed problems. You've noticed a system that isn't quite working the way you want it to.
Oh, I've noticed problems, yes. So I was talking to Robert before, who's from WFP here, and we were saying, you know, I don't think there's anyone who works in the humanitarian sector who's like, this is just going great, we're all doing a great job saving the world. I think that the humanitarian system it's really broken at the moment. We are using old methods of responding to emergencies for problems that it just wasn't built to respond to. So in the last 10 decades, the number of displaced people has doubled. The cost of responding to humanitarian crises has tripled. And we're still, you know, in some cases doing the old truck and chuck, where you bring in lots of goods and you distribute them. And I think the most recent response that I was working on was managing the earthquake response in Nepal. And while we were there, you know, me and some of the other team were saying, you know, we just have to be better at this. We've got to do something differently. We can't just keep doing the same old thing and expect to get different outcomes. So one of the things that we did there, which I'm really excited about, is that we pulled together all of the different actors in that space. And so, you know, these days it's not just big NGOs that are in the humanitarian space. There's lots of non-traditional actors like private sector, innovation companies. You know, everyone is active in this space now. So we set up an interagency innovation lab in Nepal where we could bring together local innovators from the communities that were actually affected, so Nepali innovators together with international innovators, and get them to start to respond to some of the humanitarian challenges that were happening on the ground in Nepal.
Let's pause there and talk really briefly about you in a natural disaster zone, and you look up at all these humanitarian executives and you say, we need an innovation lab.
Mm-hmm.
What was the response to that? Because we say that here in Canada, in the developed world, and they look at us and they go, what is that?
So I think yeah, probably why we started this is because, you know, we didn't even ask that question, actually. We were just really frustrated because, I mean, there is very little innovation funding or innovation that happens within the humanitarian sector anyway. I think the paper industry invests more in innovation than the humanitarian sector. And the innovation funding that is out there and the capacity that is out there, it's not sitting in the field. It's in San Francisco or it's in Geneva or it's in London. And that's great and that needs to happen as well. But as a manager of humanitarian responses, I don't see any of that getting down to the field. And my staff certainly aren't seeing that. And, I think if you asked communities, they'd be like, what? No, we're not seeing that. So we decided that we would just try and do something at the ground level and maybe get it to work and try and push that back up.
And work it did. There's some case studies, some things that you actually did. Tell me a bit about
it. It did work, yes. I think it worked. Yeah. Kamau yesterday asked me, how do you know it worked? I was like, sure, she just did. So we had some really great successes with, you know, and I'll just talk a little bit about some of the projects, but we worked with a local app developer, a Nepali app developer, together with World Vision and UNOPS to develop a open source remote monitoring software or app so that different NGOs like World Vision, CARE and Oxfam, we could all monitor our construction projects remotely, so I was working for World Vision in the earthquake response, and that meant that instead of going to 73 different construction sites and 300 housing construction sites, it means that we could just train some of our local field staff to input specific stuff into an app, take photos to make sure that, yes, there were labourers on site and the right number were there and the right mixture of cement to water to sand was being done, and that could be done remotely to ensure that quality standards were being met in the field. It meant that when the roads were blocked during monsoon, that we could still continue to monitor some of those construction sites. So that product that we tested in Nepal is now being scaled by UNOPS into 8 other humanitarian responses, and all of the agencies that piloted it in Nepal are now using that in all of their, in other humanitarian responses. So I think that's a really good example of a partnership where it was that, you know, some humanitarian actors together with local innovators, international innovators, to come up with a local solution that worked for Nepal. And I think the other thing that really worked was the lab itself. Mm. So that idea of bringing together the humanitarian players with international innovators and local innovators, that's something that we've now, some of the largest NGOs that were involved in that, in the pilot of that lab in Nepal, have decided that, you know, we want to try this in mm-hmm. other spaces. So we've taken that concept to Somalia, Uganda, Iraq, Jordan, and we're looking to move into Bangladesh and to Puerto Rico.
So this has really transformed your work personally. You came back from Nepal, back to Australia, mm-hmm. and your whole world, your whole worldview has changed.
Yeah, so I've definitely moved into a different space of work because, I mean, yeah, I could definitely continue to do to manage responses, but I think that the humanitarian system as a whole needs change. So I can do my part to try and, you know, try new things, implement things, do things differently. But I think what the humanitarian sector needs is just wholesale change. And unless we do that, we're not going to be able to meet the needs of affected communities.
Mm. Systems change is hard, very, very hard work. How do you create the runway or create the conditions within your organization, a very large organization that, you know, as you know, and as you folks know, the larger the organization, perhaps the less nimble they are. How do you personally try and create that runway or that space to be able to do this innovation work?
Yeah. So I've spoken to a few people here about the role of leadership in being able just to create that space and that ecosystem that supports this kind of systems change. And I think for me and some of my colleagues in Nepal, you know, we had to create that change at the field level, prove it at the field level, and then send it back up the chain to say, this is what, this is how we think it needs to be done in future. And it's difficult. I think it's you know, sometimes there's a will from some of the leadership, but the humanitarian sector, the way humanitarian financing is structured at the moment, is really restrictive and risk averse. So it's difficult to say to a donor, okay, thanks for this, you know, very finite amount of money. We're now going to experiment with that to try and test some products that may or may not work. Like, that's a difficult thing to ask a donor to invest in.
It requires an immense amount of trust.
Trust and appetite for risk. And also, you know, there's a lot of just has to happen work that's in a response. So a lot of agencies are just busy trying to get their regular programming done, let alone start to think about, well, what if we tried to do things differently? What if we partnered with a local Nepali e-currency group and tested out some of the ways of getting money into the hands of affected communities?
I'm loving this because as many of you who've been in the humanitarian space know, for so many years, developed nations simply tied their aid back to their own country. You couldn't even spend money in local economies in many instances, and that really withdrew and removed diversity from those very project teams. I think of Afghanistan as a really interesting example of that. In the first couple of years of humanitarian response, very difficult. So diversity becomes key. So where's our, come out, where are you? Come on up. You are another one of our international guests. You met one of our co-creators down in California. Tell these folks just a little bit about your work.
Well, thank you for having me. This is the first time I am opening my mouth in public since we have had a change of administration in your southern border country. And I've been asked a couple times if I'm embarrassed. But that said, what was not included in what I do, I'm the director of the Constellation Center for Equity and Computing. I'm on the faculty at Georgia Tech, and it matters that it's at Georgia Tech. So the gist of the problem that we're trying to address is that this, the computing skill, however you want to operationalize that, is ubiquitous. It's transforming essentially everything that happens. I think more importantly, it kind of undergirds cultural transactions in strange ways. I think we've heard here about some of the things that are happening in various kinds of applications. It influences the way that we consider value in people, et cetera. So to that extent, there is the issue of who has access to that skill set, however you want to define it. And there, the challenge, certainly in the United States, but I know that it's true everywhere, is that because it's a valuable and limited skill, the people who have access to it first are the people who are the most privileged, and they, by definition, in the country that I come from, the correlation between access, privilege, and color is finite. So one of the challenges that we have then is we're trying to assess the way that the country is going to move forward. And I'm not trying to put a disproportionate value on computing, but because it is central to, in my view, the way that citizenry is going to work, the way that the access to power is going to work, the way that you can access the autonomy over your own action in the country and ultimately in the world, if we don't democratize that skill set, then we're going to further widen the gaps between those who have and those who don't. And the premise here is that the way that this argument has been told and I think is being operationalized at the moment through the largest companies, those that are most vociferous about this is Google, Microsoft, Intel, PayPal, etc. The way that we've fashioned the argument, at least in the States, is that this is a workforce issue. We need more people to have these skills so we can have more people go work in these companies. That's not a value proposition. That's producing workers. And that's a training model. It's different than trying to produce people who are citizens. And oh, by the way, you have this skill set that enables you to do these kinds of things. But if we're trying to embed in people some sense of civic responsibility, it's a different kind of goal. And the way that that manifests itself, which I think is a problem, is because the limiting factor in the computer science space is the teachers. There just simply are not physically enough of them at any level of education. So what that has lended itself to is kind of a bifurcation of who gets trained versus who gets educated. So you take communities of people where there's challenges in what education means in communities and individual access to resources, et cetera, and you say to them, well, here, you distressed community person, in order for you to better yourself and get into this tech sector, let me just give you a certification to do this thing. Let me train you to be able to make yourself useful in some skill set. But for those students who come from communities that have access, that have privilege, that have autonomy, let me give you an education so that you can come to places like Georgia Tech and get a computer science degree, and then you can go out and look at the world in a way that's far more placed from a position of power.
And you were telling me before the systemic barriers are right from birth, or from right from the place that you grow up, depending on the elementary school, the high school that you go to. Those barriers are placed in front of you before you can even know that they're there. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, some of that is the systemic problem here. I think that there, needless to say, there's always kind of a systemic structural undergirding to any of these social problems that we address. So, for example, prior to doing what I was 2 steps ago, I was the director of the STEM Initiative for the University System of Georgia. So that our system has 30 public higher education institutions, 330,000 students. So the question to me was, figure out how to make the STEM education, science, technology, engineering, math, better across that system. So one of the challenges, of course, there at the outset is to figure out, well, what are the places that are preventing people from getting success? And math, of course, is one of them. So to the school colleagues that were here, that young lady who last night said she doesn't like math, I was mad at you right away. I can't see you right now, but as soon as I do. But the thing about the systems there is that we have schools where, I'm not sure the nomenclature of mathematics up here, but we have schools in Georgia where if you don't take calculus in the 12th grade, then you can't really come to Georgia Tech because we don't even offer pre-calculus. So there's a structural barrier that's built into the transition from secondary school to post-secondary school at this level. But there are whole swaths of schools across the state and across the South that don't get to calculus. So you take individual students, you give them a system that is itself limiting. So they do everything you've asked them to do, and they still come up short. And those places are built in the communities that the students of color, if students in rural communities and students that are poor wherever they live, they go to those schools.
And we're leaving geniuses on the table, right? Like that's the thing here is that because of this, there are discoveries, there are advancements, there is change that isn't being made. When we look at the change that is being made, when we look at blockchain, Ethereum, Bitcoin, when we look at these so-called revolutionary technologies, there is often a dark side. There's a downside to it, which is that the people who have the earliest and fastest access to it usually are cisgendered, white, heterosexual males. The work you're doing is to try and combat that. Are you hopeful? Where are you at right now on things like revolutionary technologies of blockchain, solving diversity? Because it's an easy thing to say, but it's a really hard thing to implement.
Well, let's be clear. But I did not say that I'm combating white men. Let's just be clear. I don't think I'd win, but nevertheless. What I am saying, though, is that I think hope is in the fight. I think that the barriers, so here's a practical example of that. Because the limiting factor, let's just be specific now. So in this computing game, the limiting factor is the teachers. So we don't have an infrastructure where there's a cultural orientation to high-quality teachers, certainly in the United States. That's not true around the world, but it's true in the United States. So if we, as an institution of public higher education, want to say that we're going to try to address this particular problem such that it doesn't accelerate the speed at which those same white men that I'm supposed to be combating are running away from everybody else, we have to then provide some content to schools and communities that don't otherwise have it. The challenge there, which is the blind spot in all of this, is with the best of intentions, because those communities that are the most privileged and have access to and are hungry and are curious and are always searching, they can find those things and make better use of them because the schools and the systems and the communities that they're in undergird and support their ambition and their curiosity. So one of the things that we have to be very careful of, and it's not a moral conflict, but it is a moral problem, where we don't want to restrict the progress of anyone, but to try to make sure that we have people who need to take the most advantage of it, be able to take the most advantage of it.
And at that same time, recognize the network effect and the amplification of the network effect of privilege. Privilege begets privilege. And unless there's something that's inserted to stop that cycle will replicate itself.
Well, the other thing is, if you are in elite circles, which we are, so one of the things that happens at places like Georgia Tech, and there's this idea too, like this imposter syndromes thing. Mm. So where you get to these places and you feel like somehow I shouldn't really be there. But you get to a place like Tech, and because everybody who's there has had an elite education, everybody. Mm. In order to be there, certainly as a faculty person, you have to have had some kind of very elite education. Yeah. And because of that, there's a particular pathway. Of course, there are anomalies to this, where there are people who just, you can't hold them down, they're just gonna win regardless. But most people who are in this circle, they've never had to deal with street level problems. Mm. And let me give you the example of how that works, real quick. Catherine and I were just talking about this last night. I went to the University of Texas, El Paso, the other day. So they asked me to come and give this lecture. And one of the things that was interesting about it was I'd never been on this border city. So this is Ciudad Juarez and El Paso. So the border is right there. And in the climate of Trump, et cetera, it's all dangerous. But there are 2,000 students who live in Juarez that go to school in El Paso, and they have to cross the border every day. So when they cross that border, as a practical matter, what that means is that they have to go and deal with men with guns, with dogs, and then they got to go to class. So this thing that we were just talking about, Supriya and Indy were talking about, the cognitive tax of being poor, the cognitive tax of being preyed upon, of being in a community where people don't want you to be there, is itself a challenge. So then in our estimation, if we're trying to address that, we have to be very, very considerate of those kinds of biases that are explicit, they're not implicit biases, and how do we address those in the context of an educational structure that's going to be effective for them.
It's incredible, and that reminds me of the UCLA study that was recently done that demonstrated that countries with equal rights for LGBTQ2 citizens have per capita $365 more per person in per capita GDP. That's huge, and that's the difference between when they were not equal and didn't have same-sex marriage and full equality to the point that they were equal. That's the difference. So literally an increase of $365 literal dollars per person every single year on average in those nations. I want to bring up our other panelists so they can talk to each other and we can get to the Slido questions. Thank you so much. Supriya, come on up. Ethan, come on up. I want to move back just a little bit, not too far back. I'll fall off the stage. But let's. Who's got a question for somebody else on the panel? Who wants to dig into something that somebody else had to say? From you guys, I want you guys to chat with each other here. Any tough questions for the blockchain guy over here? Any blockchain guy? You gonna help out humanitarian?
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
I mean, firstly, I don't understand half of what you're saying, Ethan. It sounds incredibly smart. But, I mean, for example, we used a project built on Ethereum in the Nepal response. We had a local Nepali innovation company, and they built a Nepali rupee-backed e-currency program built on Ethereum. Am I saying it right? And that was being designed to try and support microloans and microinsurance and facilitate remittances. But that's just one project in one humanitarian response. And so I think that, as you said, there's an incredible amount of opacity in humanitarian financing. So it'd be really interesting to hear from you. How do you see this kind of technology being used to not just run projects, but to actually transform humanitarian financing?
Yeah, so in the first part, you might want to use Ethereum because it essentially provides the infrastructure and the security guarantees that it would be really hard for an organization to set up, like the IT, the information technology infrastructure, because people in government know it's really expensive to run the security on this stuff and get login accounts and then let alone manage a currency, right? That's so kind of nice thing about Ethereum is it does all of that for you. We handle like all the decentralization and the security side of stuff on our end. Well, the community does, really. No one company does this on our side. So that's a huge, enormous guarantees. It means that projects like what you're doing on can deploy kind of innovative projects like this for practically free because you don't have to spend millions on IT. And the second part, I was going to talk about this earlier, was the for the transformation in terms of like projects on the ground. One of them that we've invested in is one called Eudara, as I was talking about, is where if I put money into a project, I want to see that it's actually getting done. And I also want to make sure that the people on the ground maybe get a little compensation for it, and it's not just going into some corrupt manager's hands. So if we essentially make the smart contracts the managers, and get rid of the middlemen, get rid of these intermediaries that could like cause friction, take some extra, like too many fees for it, and me as a donor, I get to see like, yeah, my money's, I can see where my money's going to. I know that it's going to build the outhouse, or it's going to build the plumbing, or it's going to like provide sort of the routers or do something on the ground. And I know that there's public verification and social proof that it's actually been finished, and the people who built it are getting paid to do it, right? Small compensation, because do any of these volunteer efforts or protest movements, you can't do them without, unless you're wealthy. Speaking of disparities, right? You have to be relatively wealthy to volunteer for some of these things, to live in Wall Street and do Occupy Wall Street. You can't just take time off, right? Most people can't, right? So it'd be nice to compensate people. And me as a donor, I'd like to see that the money is going somewhere specifically and it's helping the people and it's helping the project move forward. And we can create tasks under these to figure out what are the right kind of tasks and vote on those that should be done. How do we create these movements and make them successful and provide outside expertise that maybe even an aid organization couldn't do themselves? They might not have all the talent and the skill set and they have to hire really expensive contractors or consultants to do it. Get the community. There's a lot of good experts around. They can contribute. And together, right, we can use the Ethereum platform to provide transparency, auditability, and trust, and get things done, and then make these movements more successful and longer lasting.
Cool. Other questions for?
I have one.
You go ahead. I'll go next.
It's to you. So if the idea of Ethereum, for example, the way, if I'm just going to extrapolate for a little bit, what it sounded like is that you extract some of the cognitive load off these governments for them to be able to focus on other things. Yeah. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, we, like our pitch is in the early days, designing why would we build this, it's like let us handle like all the decentralization, or at least 90% of the tasks. Don't go out and build a new blockchain. Don't go out and build a whole new platform for what you're doing. Kind of like a smartphone. You don't go and build a new smartphone to like run an application, like a Twitter or something. No, you just go and you build on top of what's currently available. Let Apple do it. Let Google build the infrastructure. Same thing on the blockchain. The infrastructure is there. You just go build your app, and you do what you're good at doing, and you build stuff that changes the world.
So the loose analogy here is that So if we were going to have the cognitive tax that you talked about, so if that's associated with poverty, predatory cultures, etc., what's the platform? How do you compensate for that in ways that enable those communities who are besieged upon in ways that it taxes their own intellect to be able to function on a platform to perform in school, to perform in jobs, to perform in ways that you'd expect?
Yeah. You know, so the interesting thing about the poverty depressing thing about it is that it's really just about scarcity. So it's not limited to money. Like you could, you know, those multidimensional poverty indices, right? So you could have a shortage of cash, you could have a shortage of access to roads or healthcare or schooling options. And all of these, this sort of presence of scarcity and the cognitive burden of that is what imposes the tax. So in terms of countermeasures and what we can do is what are specific ways that we can take away some of that burden? So for instance, you might do things like there's this great program looking at, you know, we have to file for like the federal aid for schooling. This was actually done in the U.S. And so providing help to students in completing that form or partially completing that form for them, because a lot of that information you can get from tax forms, significantly increases the likelihood that students will actually complete the form, actually get the funding, actually go to school, actually graduate from school, all the sort of downstream things. Now, if every step of the way there are drop-offs, it's not that it's the magic bullet, not like Ethan's unicorn on the shirt. But if we can, in systematic ways, create bandwidth by taking away the burden, so that bandwidth can take the form of very explicit things, like what you were describing isn't about implicit biases, as you said. It's just about explicit lack of infrastructure or resources. We've just created an unfair society, so people just don't even have the options, right? That, to my mind, requires what you are doing right now. Literally, like, no, like, this is not okay. We have to fix the situation so the options at least exist. Over and above that, where the kind of work that I do comes in is, how can we create choice environments, architectures, decision environments in which people, when they are operating, are not overly burdened? So in Canada, for instance, I'll give you an example. We have this thing called the Canada Learning Bond. It's a seed grant for low-income families. If you're a low-income family, you open a type of education savings plan, which everybody is eligible for. The government just gives you money, up to $2,000, quote-unquote free money, in that there is no, you don't have to contribute. There are no strings attached. At the same time, rationally, great program, right? Like, everybody should do it. Uptake is 33%, 67% of eligible families. That's 1.68 million children currently in Canada who don't have this, who don't have a Canada Learning Bond. And the problem is the process that we've set up for it imposes so many burdens. So who is eligible families? Commonly a single parent, commonly a woman, commonly working multiple jobs. To open the account, you have to set up an appointment with a financial advisor, go into a bank and make a wet signature. Mm-hmm. Is she even banked? Well, actually, a large amount of Canada is banked, so probably she is. But the process is imposing these issues, right? So there, the solution would be, can we just build this to be online? Can we just build it such that the whole thing just happens online for her or him, as the case may be? But so I hope that answers your question. But essentially, it's like, can we make procedural changes mm-hmm. that makes it easier for people to do the things that they need to do that will help them?
I was really interested in this idea that you had about this bandwidth, sort of these programs, these initiatives, these ideas creating this additional bandwidth so that people can reduce that amount of cognitive taxing. Did you see, is that what the Innovation Lab in Nepal did, was create this space bandwidth per se?
I definitely had feedback from a lot of our humanitarian partners that came into the lab that it provided that space where they could fail. So they could break off a little bit of funding, put someone over there, get on with their normal program that they have to deliver, but experiment with, you know, some local innovators, with some international innovators, try, fail, try again, fail again, and come up with some, with some products or successes that they can then take back to their organisation to say, like the one with UNOPS, to come back and say, hey, we've tried this, and now we can scale it. But I don't know many humanitarian organisations that have that luxury within their normal programming, and that's increasing the appetite for that and the acceptance that we have to innovate and we have to change the way that we do things. But a lot of organisations definitely needed that bandwidth to be able to expand and play around and a facilitated ecosystem where they could come in contact with other actors in the space that they wouldn't necessarily come across normally.
I love it. We've got some rapid-fire questions from Slido. So I've got a couple questions here that our awesome Jason Furman has selected, and I want to fire them at a couple of you folks. Supriya, you're first up here, because this is a full-on behavioral science question, I think, anyway. Can you include anger as part of an employee evaluation? Is that a thing you can do? You'd love to?
I'd love to. Yeah. I think it's really important, and I think that if you have employees who are all enraged by their managers, then we need to do something about those managers.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Over in the world of diversity and sort of this notion of trickle down, oftentimes, you know, I see this in technology itself, which is, you know, the best computers that were in the richest neighborhoods eventually end up into poorer neighborhoods, eventually end up overseas. It's literally a trickle down of hardware that's like, oh, I don't need this anymore. You take it. So the question that's here is how do we practically move away from that style of trickle down capacity model?
Well, I think relative to some of the conversation that happened earlier, in part, the language matters. So I think even in contextualizing it as an issue of diversity, to some extent trivializes it. Because the diversity term itself has become this kind of thing, well, let's let the blacks have such a, or the Hispanics have whatever. Which is why I think that if you consider this in the context of democratizing skills, then it's elevating the nature of all the individual people as citizens. And I think that that's relevant to the point that Indy made earlier about how do you operationalize freedom and liberation at the individual level. And as a consequence of that, if that's the premise upon which we're going to base this trickle-down thing that you're talking about, we wouldn't see it that way. We wouldn't say that there's some priority that has to be given first to these privileged few, after which then it can be dispersed to whomever, the standards for which would then have risen so that whatever it is that they're getting is typically not going to make them at the level that they need to be. So it's implicit in the way that we're even thinking about how to give and what is the motivation behind philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, I think some of the things that we've had to do at tech is to advise people who want to be involved in this diversity and inclusion. All these tech companies want to come in and figure out what they should do. But in many cases, what I was alluding to before is that the trickle-down idea is that, well, you're in a situation that is itself destitute. Mm. So therefore, we just want to give you something. And the something that I'm going to give you, this is how Vinod and I met way back when, the something that I'm going to give you is not something that I want for myself.
There you go.
And so ethically, you're committing a crime even in doing it, despite the fact that you're doing it with good intentions.
So instead of handing $100 crank laptops to inner cities, we should be giving them quantum computing centers.
Not only that, we should be giving them the kind of school setups such that if they do everything that we're asking them to do, then they can actually be successful. Because the way that it's set up right now, you can do everything that you've been asked to do and you still fail. And that's not the kid's fault. And that is in part of this idea, well, let's diversify. Mm-hmm. And just real quick, let me just say that the last point on that, and then I'll stop, because you told me already that men talk too much. But the thing is that the distinction between equity and inclusion, or between equity and equality, is if we go back to the word equity means fairness. It means justice, the absence of bias. Equality is just the equal distribution of stuff among people. So you can have equal distribution with inequitable outcomes because you haven't considered the fact that you're putting this thing, whatever it is, the computer, the teacher, into a school that is itself inoperable. And therefore, if you come into it with that frame of mind, then you wouldn't deal with this trickle-down thing the way that, mm-hmm. That we typically do.
Awesome. Catherine, there is a lot of power imbalance in humanitarian work. And that is obviously, that power imbalance has definitely channeled your work. How would you practically advise other people to take some of the steps in channeling frustration and anger into on-the-ground action like in your innovation lab? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I would say that, I hope, and if I think, 10, 20 years down the track, that humanitarian responses look very differently and that it won't be someone that looks like me sitting here talking about how to respond in a humanitarian response. It will be the first responders, which are the local people on the ground. So, and I think the more that we see people being exposed to emergencies, the more practice they get, unfortunately, because the number of emergencies are increasing. And the kind of access that people have to, if Musk gets, universal internet access, what does it look like for a humanitarian response when everyone's connected to the internet, when there's different players in that humanitarian space? Mm-hmm. Do you even need people like me to go in and work on these humanitarian responses? So I think that, if we talk about power within the humanitarian response or within the humanitarian sector, it's still a very Western-led you know, especially for the large-scale humanitarian responses, it still looks like a certain kind of thing where, you know, it's the money comes from Western donors. There's a lot of international influence in what those responses look like. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's happening more and more where we see this localization of responses, where communities are more active, where governments are more practiced at responding to their own emergencies, where public sector in developing countries is more active. And so I think some of that can start to redress some of that power imbalance. But I think it's going to be really difficult because, you know, the people that hold the power and the money, they probably don't want to let go of that.
But I'm impressed, though, that you're here from one of the biggest humanitarian organizations, and that's exactly what you're suggesting you're doing, right? You're stepping away. You're saying, just like the Ethereum project could do, could remove those middle managers, as you were talking about, right? So in that space. What I'm really sort of interested in here, to just wrap up, we've only got a couple minutes, Ethan, is ecosystems. You are talking about literally the installation of, you know, wholesale installation of a brand new ecosystem of technology that people are going to have to understand, adapt, and bring on board. But there's some negative sides to that as well, right? So can you talk just a little bit in closing about how we can actually do these things? So, you know, if these folks out here are looking to leverage blockchain, they're looking to leverage anger, they're looking to do those things, like, is there a URL? Where do they go? What do they learn? Because, like, with all respect, we have not taught these folks about blockchain yet. You know, like, is anybody clearer right now than they were at the beginning? No. Okay. Some of you, yes, are like, no. So where do they go? How do they practically inject this into their ecosystem? Because we saw some practicality here. I'm not sure we fully expect to be like, well, on the ground in Nepal, the Ethereum platform was used for the fall. How do these folks do that? How do they do that? I mean, other than contracting you, of course.
Can I just quickly, very quickly add to that? And also, Ethan, so I'm 100% a believer, but how are we to prevent the inaction of another technocracy, which, you know, like the Googles and the Amazons of the world who are sort of the... So right now, you guys are a bunch of hippie liberals who are like, we're going to, you know, stand up to the man. But one day, there's going to be other people who are part of this. And then we have this systems of injustices that you know, we've just been talking about. And so how, like, what is the...
Is there a what? Darth Unicorn. Yeah.
I love it.
Hope not. This one will become victorious.
All on you.
Yeah. I'm not ending on a negative note. Yes, a few things there. With the tech, let's start on the technocracy. It's an excellent, obviously an excellent point. We at Ethereum and all this whole blockchain communities come out of a very libertarian, open idea of technology should be free for people. Let's get rid of the patents that restrict innovation, that restrict people from like building things because they can't afford the lawyers to go after. Let's keep this stuff open source. We do at the Ethereum Foundation and the stuff that we build at L4. It's all open source. Our stuff's MIT licensed. You can use it for commercial or private use whatsoever. Fully, freely available. And we don't put any restrictions on that technology. Now, the technocracy part we're going, the fact that we make it available doesn't mean people can read it or that they can understand how to use it. So that's obviously a problem, but we, like myself, run a 1,500-member meetup group in Toronto called the Ethereum Developers Meetup Group, and that came about just from saying, hi, I want to learn how to, especially I build these things, right, but it's like, how do I build certain contracts, or how do I learn more about it, and who the heck in the space is also building this stuff, and so we get anybody else who's just interested and can spend some time, it just costs time at this point, go in and learn collectively to discuss the technology, learn how to do some of this coding, have some help on the business plan, figure out where to make network connections, because that's vitally important. It's like, who do we talk to in this space? Where does make these connections? And so that's free. And now there's also a lot of resources coming up online for tutorials. And there's still the tech side. You have to have access to a computer on that, and you need to have access to time, which is a kind of a luxury for some. And so if you just search like Ethereum developers in Toronto, I just started a meetup. So I just moved to Montreal. So there's one called ETH Montreal, ethmontreal.com. And on there, I've got a little list of some starting resources. And you can always reach out to me or come to these meetups that we run. And I encourage you to like start one in your own city as well.
And I would just add to that, you'd be surprised how accessible developers actually are. We oftentimes have cliches and stereotypes about developers, and a lot of them are like Ethan. They're pretty easy to talk to and kind of awesome.
Friendly.
Friendly, and willing to explain things in more detail than we've got the time to be able to do today. Thank you, each and every one of you. I really, really appreciate it. I'm going to hand this microphone back to Jane.
Thank you so much, Plenary 3.